Les colloques du Collège de France.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be here today. Sadly, not because I will reveal now a breakthrough discovery on human singularity, but rather because Stan has been an inspiring scientific figure for me since I started doing research. He co-supervised my PhD thesis, as Marco said, but his influence on my work goes well beyond the single paper in Frontiers that we published together. The paper that actually triggered my excitement for cognitive computational modeling is this 2003 PNS paper from Stan, Claire, and Jean-Pierre Changeux, which describes a computational model of the global workspace to explain behavioral and EEG studies of the attentional blink, experiments that Claire and Stan conducted during her PhD. So I reread it last week and felt really, not just as a flattery, that it could have been published just a year or a month ago. So it's not Stan's work on mathematics in the brain that inspired me, but rather the way that Stan, like only few others, I think, at the time, at least to my knowledge, used mathematics to understand how the mind works. So over the years, my group has shamelessly copied Stan's cognitive computational modeling approach to study human behavior. And today, I would like to present what I think is a very mildly controversial, but hopefully useful, take on how cognitive models can be used to answer three distinct classes of questions about the human mind, what I will call what questions, how questions, and why questions. And in the interest of time, I will focus on a single recent unpublished study from my group where we have asked what, how, and why questions to understand multidimensional perceptual decisions. So what are we talking about here? Perceptual decisions made in uncertain conditions, as you can read, are based on the gradual accumulation of noisy sensory evidence over time. This quote could have been taken from the dozens and hundreds of reviews on perceptual decisions, but here I just asked ChatGPT. So outside the lab, this is what perceptual decisions look like. Should I break right now? Should I eat this thing? Should I reach a diagnosis based on this? As you can see in all of these examples, decisions are based not only on evidence accumulation in time, as in this quote, but also across different visual features, shape, color, motion, texture, etc. Are we well equipped to study these types of decisions in the lab? Well, we have the random dot motion pattern, we have noisy Gabor patterns, each used by thousands of studies of perceptual decisions. The problem, as you can see, is that these two stimuli only have one relevant sensory feature, motion direction on the left, orientation on the right. So the question that we asked in my lab is, can humans make accurate perceptual decisions based on arbitrary, context-dependent combinations of multiple features? We know we have to make these decisions outside the lab, but how accurate are we at making them? I have asked myself this question like almost 10 years ago, and thanks to my postdoc Lucas Benjamin, who actually did his PhD with Ghislaine, he's here, we took the data out of the file drawer and tried to answer it by first comparing human decisions to the Bayes optimal benchmark. So that's the first form of modeling. So the stimuli that we have used in these studies are two-dimensional, right? So they are these colored shapes that are taken from this 2D space map. So if I show you just one exemplar, this stimulus is defined by a color and a shape. So you can measure its color and its shape on these two feature axes. And in some of the trials of the task, we have asked subjects to make 1D decisions, for example, color decisions, sometimes shape decisions. Huh? At this stage, some of you may be thinking, hold on, I have already read about the neural geometry of these kinds of decisions, and you would be right. So 10 years ago, this paper from the Newsom lab, published in Nature, has studied exactly the neural geometry of this feature selection process. In these 1D decisions, you have to select the relevant feature and ignore the other ones. So you see, even their stimulus space is very similar to ours. But there's a twist. We did not study only these 1D decisions based on these 2D colored shapes, where the decision axis is aligned with one of the features. But we've also studied 2D decisions that are based on combinations of color and shape. Here, for example, decisions between blue square and red diamond, where you can see that the decision axis is tilted by 45 degrees. At this stage, some of you may again be thinking, oh, hold on, I've already read about the combination of sensory features even a very long time ago. And indeed, I'm a bit like 45 years late to this party, as you can see from this landmark paper from Anne Treisman. But here there's a twist again. So feature integration theory was interested mostly in how humans segregate and localize objects during visual search, for example, looking for the red diamond in this pattern. Don't flatter yourself if you found the red diamond. And this is what they call an easy search. This is what they call now a difficult search. Right? So again, there's a twist. In our study, we were not interested in how humans segregate these 2D objects, but how they aggregate the information provided by several objects that have multiple features to make a single decision at the end of the trial. So this is how the task works, and this is how a Bayesian observer would solve the task. Every time the subject was presented with an object, the Bayesian observer would extract the log likelihood associated with that object, so the probability ratio that it would be generated from a blue-colored sequence or a red-colored sequence. It's very similar if you think of a 1D decision, like a color decision like this, or a 2D decision, like the decision between this blue square and the red diamond. Then across stimuli that we presented to the subject on the screen, you would aggregate and sum this evidence to reach, at the end of the trial, when you're probed for a decision, here with this go signal, with a decision variable that reflects the probability ratio that the sequence as a whole was drawn from one of the two categories. So let's see how humans performed in this task. First, the 1D decisions, and as you can see, we just replicate what people have observed with non-human primates, unsurprisingly. So for color decisions, you can see that the decisions about color were strongly influenced by the Bayesian decision variable corresponding to color, based on color, but not at all by the decision variable corresponding to shape, and vice versa for the shape context. Now what's interesting is what will happen if I do the same for 2D decisions, and pretty much the same. You can see that humans are quite good at making 2D decisions between, for example, here, the blue square and the red diamond. So as you can see, their decisions on the y-axis are strongly related to the decision variable for the relevant decision axis, and only very weakly related to information on the orthogonal, irrelevant decision axis that would be between a blue diamond and a red square. Right? So as you can see, if we just model very simply how people are weighting these different Bayesian features on every decision, you see that for color decisions, very sensitive to color, shape decisions sensitive to shape, and in the 2D context, they were sensitive to both. So now, the answer to the what question is that humans can make 2D decisions based on arbitrary features. Now, how is the human mind integrating evidence to make these 2D decisions? So for this, we have arbitrated between different integration strategies. And first, just to show you how it works for 1D decision, we've looked at these more simple decisions to see how the brain selects the relevant features and ignores the irrelevant one. And for this, we've used MEG. So just to show you what I'm going to show you for the rest of the talk, which will be short, I will decode three different aspects of each object that was presented to the subject in every sequence of the task and checked how well I could decode it from MEG activity. So the x-axis is always time from the onset of the object, and on the y-axis is the decoding strength. The first quantity that we decoded is just the aspect of the stimulus, the color or the shape of the stimulus. And here I'm just averaging the two. So as you can see, we can decode that aspect. We can also decode the salience of the object, how much the color or the shape of the object was category diagnostic or ambiguous, and also how much the object was either consistent with what the subject had accumulated, integrated so far, or inconsistent with it. Okay, so that's this integration variable that we also can decode. If we try to localize these different representations in the brain using space-resolved analysis, we can see that the aspect of the stimulus is in the visual cortex, the salience mostly in the visual cortex, but that the integration variable is much more widespread and includes the posterior parietal and the prefrontal cortex. So now I've just shown you the decoding of all these variables for the target feature in 1D decisions, the one that subjects should care about. So how well could we decode the ignored dimension? So I'm showing you now the two other curves, and the red one is the ignored dimension in these 1D decisions. So what you can see is that we could decode very well the feature, for example, the color of the stimulus, when the shape was irrelevant. The salience, we could also decode it very well, but you can see that this ignored information was decaying much faster than the relevant one. And if you look at the integration stage now, we could almost only decode the relevant information. So in terms of strength of selection, you can see that across this hierarchy of processing the stimulus, the selection grew progressively. And that's replicating the results of the Newsom lab study, that at the integration stage only is the selection full. So now something interesting is that if we try to predict the accuracy of individual decisions from these decoding patterns, you can see that the decoding of the aspect of the stimulus was not related to accuracy, neither was the silence, but the integration of the object with the prior belief was predictive of the accuracy of the subject. We could decode better that quantity prior to correct decisions. There is another aspect of that task that is important. It's not only the selection, but also the degree of abstraction, which is how well we could decode a variable by using the same variable in the other context. Whether I could, for example, here, decode the color of a stimulus from its shape. Okay, and as you can see, we can't do it. It's a control, right? In terms of salience, this transfer was also very limited. And only at the integration stage, progressively, you can see that we could decode almost equally well the integration variable using the trials that the subject was doing right now, for example, color trials, by using the integration pattern that we had decoded from the shape trials, meaning that this code, and only this code, is abstract in this task, right? So now let's move to the 2D decisions. How many minutes I have left?
3.5.
Okay. Oh. So now it's about combinations. And we had two hypotheses. During the 2D decisions, there are two strategies that are equally accurate, but that are very different in terms of how the subjects do. One possibility is that subjects integrate these two features in parallel, color and shape, and only at the end of the trial combine them to reach a decision variable. The other possibility is that subjects project each stimulus on the tilted decision axis and only accumulate only one scalar variable, which is this tilted evidence over time to reach a decision. As you can see, the decision variable at the end of the trial is exactly the same for both. So behavior will not be able to tell us which strategy the brain is using. But maybe you can see that the trajectories are different, so we can decode them from brain activity to see which one is best decodable from MEG activity. Okay? So if subjects were processing the two features in parallel, we would best decode these two features. But if subjects are processing evidence in a tilted fashion, we should decode better the evidence projected on the decision axis than the other possibilities. Okay? So we've done this exactly for these variables, and as you can see, the aspect of the stimulus is clearly processed in parallel. The salience of the stimulus is also processed in parallel for the two features, but the integration of the stimulus is not. It seems that the best variable that we can decode is the integration of the objects projected on the decision axis. Okay, so clearly, these two are compatible with H1, parallel sensory processing, and this one with tilted integration. So I'm going to skip this abstract question. But now the answer to the how question is that humans seem to be making 2D decisions through a 1D integration of 2D sensory evidence projected on the tilted decision axis, not by integrating in parallel the two features. And so I just want to go quickly as to why do humans project 2D sensory evidence on this tilted decision axis. And for this, we have optimized artificial neural networks to try to answer this question. So maybe at this stage, I'm speaking a bit fast, but I think I'm speaking clearly still. At this stage, some of you may again be thinking, oh, hold on, I have already read about the idea of answering why questions with artificial neural networks, and you would be right. Nancy published recently a review about this. And so I'm just using exactly the same approach. So here we have compared two types of recurrent neural networks that we trained on doing the exact same task as the subject. The split networks that I'm showing you here had two distinct feature selective pools of units that were either sensitive to color or to shape. And at the bottom, we have mixed networks which had only a single pool of 2D selective neurons that had mixed selectivity to color and shape, right? The two networks were matched in terms of their number of connections, and we added noise to them during their training and testing. So if you don't add noise to these networks and you test them on that 2D decision task, you see that they are exactly on top of the base optimal line. Here I'm showing you how well the network performed as a function of the number of objects in the sequence for the split and the mixed networks, right? If you add noise to the networks, just like humans, they become suboptimal. Now, of course, in the split networks, we were hoping by design that the networks had to integrate information in parallel, whereas in the mixed networks, because they had mixed selectivity, the units could project the stimuli on the decision axis. So we just found out that it was the case. So if we try to decode color, shape, decision axis, null axis from the color selective pool, we see that pool processes color. The other one, the shape selective pool, processes shape. And the network just read out at the end of the trial using this parallel integration strategy, the decision variable. The mixed networks, it's different, you know? The single pool of neurons was indeed representing better the decision axis than the two feature axis, saying that that network was actually, like humans, tilting the evidence prior to its integration, and just like the other one, was then reading out very selectively the decision variable. Now, the last thing I want to show you in the last minute is that, can we understand why humans were using H2 relative to H1, were tilting the evidence on the decision axis? And for this, what we've done is just progressively add noise to these networks to see how well the mixed networks and the split networks were robust to the addition of noise in them. And when we did that, from zero noise at the top where the two networks are optimal to infinite noise when the two are at chance, you see that mixed networks are more robust than split networks to the addition of noise when they're making 2D decisions. This benefit is way smaller if we test the networks, the same exact networks now trained on 1D decisions. And these benefits are not present if you add input noise, noise at the input of the recurrent layer, or noise at the output of the recurrent layer. So why do humans project 2D sensory evidence on this tilted axis prior to integration? Because that strategy increases robustness to noise. So I'm not going to tell you now that this is not Mars hierarchy that I've restated in 20 minutes. It's not, but I can tell you why. And I'm just going to thank my team, especially Lucas, who has worked with me on this. Thank the funding agencies and, of course, you for listening to me.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.